Hi, this is Exhibiting Kinship, a podcast dedicated to discussing Indigenous interventions in the museum world. I'm one of your hosts, Felicia Garcia.
And I'm your other host, Miranda Roberts. And today it is my great pleasure to be able to bring to you, our listeners, two amazing scholars and artists that I can call friends, Dr. Rob Collins and artist Monica Rickert. We brought these two individuals in this week to discuss some of the things happening around Black History Month, specifically at the Field Museum. While we believe in celebrating Black voices every day, we wanted to use our platform to highlight how Native American and African American history converge. And our guests today identify both as Native American and African American. And though they have both in some respect are working with the Native American Hall renovation at the Field Museum, they have also been creating content for the celebrations happening around Black History Month. Both have worked together to write about the relevance of Native America to Black History Month. And so, yeah, please join me in welcoming Dr. Rob Collins and Monica Rickert-Bolter, if you want to go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Robert Keith Collins. I'm an associate professor of American Indian Studies at San Francisco State University. This is an honor. A little bit about myself. My research focuses on African and Native American contact and interactions, as well as cultural changes in North, Central, and South America. So I am African American, but Chata Ishtiali, which in the Choctaw language means I'm also of Choctaw descent. And so today is a really good day. I love talking about this history, and I may nerd out on you a little.
Thank you, Monica.
It's a good thing. Hi, I'm Monica Rickert-Bolter. I'm Prairie Band Potawatomi, African American, and German. I am an artist. I've been doing some visual art for, since I can remember. And I am also a journalist for Native News Online with a primary focus on arts and entertainment. I have also worked with the Native community here in Chicago for going on 10 years now. And I just am so thrilled to be a part of this. So thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you for both being on. It's so amazing to be able to bring friends and family onto this with us to discuss all of these different topics. And I think that if Felicia's good with it, we'll just go ahead and jump right in to getting to know more about the work that you've been doing.
Yeah, it's really an honor to be able to meet you all. And that's like one really great thing about this podcast is Miranda and I get to introduce each other to some really wonderful people from our own networks and bring them together to create this wonderful community for our podcast. I would love to hear more about how your work at the Field Museum began and your role in the Black History Month celebrations at the Field Museum.
Ms. Moni, you want to go first?
Sure. So one of the community engagement coordinators there at the Field Museum, Deborah Yupapan, she and I have been really good friends for years now, and she kind of helps get me involved a little bit more. I used to do some volunteer work at the Field Museum, so I got to meet some pretty amazing people there, and I just kind of want to help support that museum in any way I can. And once I heard about the hall renovation, and I was asked to contribute, so I'm working on two installations right now. One will be a mural, and one will focus, it's actually a joint project with Kai Pyle, who is a trans poet, and we will be focusing on the story of Ralph Carino, a trans person from the early 1900s living here in Chicago and in the Milwaukee area, who kind of went through some sensational stuff with the media. So, and it's just a fascinating story. So I think that is definitely something that needs to be shared. This person was African-American and Potawatomi. So even cooler.
Definitely.
Yeah, for me, I got a conversation, I believe it was in Frankfurt, Germany, from Dr. Alika, asking me what I was doing in terms of research and work, and that the Field Museum was planning this project on the Native North American Hall, and would I be interested in hearing more about it. And so when I got back to SF State, I had received an email from her saying that there was going to be this renovation, deinstallation, and reinstall, and was I interested in possibly working on it, given my expertise in American Indian cultural changes, but then also African and Native American contact. And it's really exciting that this discussion about Black History Month is occurring, because that feeds right into, I think, what's my contribution, or has been my contributions to the project, which I'm very excited about. One is getting, you know, Chicago to really think about how it came into being from African Native American contact, particularly Kitihawa, as well as Dusable. And then also in terms of migration over time, Chicago is like one of the hubs for the great migration for African Americans. But many of these individuals, especially coming out of Mississippi, you can see it in the flags in the Native American Community Center, are Mississippi Choctaws. And that is something that a lot of, you know, individuals, I think, need to know about the dynamics of the African-American population that was coming to Chicago. So I'll just stop there with those two contributions, because I think those have been the main ones that I've given in terms of, you know, aiding this process along, because it's an incredible group of Native scholars, incredible group of artists that are coming in, and researchers that are really helping, I think, the Field Museum to come into its own in terms of a new paradigm where the material culture is wedded with individual voices. And I think especially for this project on Black history, having an artist such as, you know, Miss Moni is really important, because then it shows not only that people were a part of the past, they are also still doing great works in the present.
Beautiful. Yes, definitely. Definitely. It's so amazing to be able to work with you both. How were you? I think I know the story of how you became, working with Rita Brooks, who has been doing the Black History Month programming at the Field Museum, but did Deborah introduce you both, and how did the blog post that will be posted towards the end of the month come about?
Well, Tori reached out to me, and yeah, I think that was with Deborah's kind of request to reach out to me. But I was thrilled to be part of this, because sometimes I'm not always included in African American stuff, and I think people just forget. So yeah.
Yeah, I would say the same. Miss Tori reached out, and then we met Miss Rita, and they asked, "Are you interested in contributing?" And I'm like, "How much do you need?" And so, because you know, I'm gonna have to be told to shut up. And one of the major reasons is because this, I see this blog as not just a blog where people are getting information. They're actually being exposed to, in my area of research, which is actually the untold story of contact. So it is what is referred to in anthropology as by A. Irving Halliwell as the third dimension of contact. It wasn't paid attention to because interactions between Europeans and Native Americans and in multiple directions were the center focus of analysis. And what was going on behind the scenes was all of these dynamic contacts between African Americans and Native Americans that kind of went under the radar. Most people didn't think that there were Native American people of African ancestry or African American people with Native American ancestry, and that these contacts had happened. So this blog really kind of gets folks to pay attention to, which is the major theme here, the shared kinship that was formed as fellow slaves, as well as in allies in self-determination and resistance. And I would also go so far as to say sovereignty, especially the individuals, one of the individuals that's presented, and I'll talk about that later, but these individuals really give us a sense of, you know, Native sovereignty impacting African Americans, but then also African Americans being agents in the usage of Native American cultures, languages, et cetera, in both as slaves as well as fellow citizens within tribal nations. And this dynamic, I think, is really important, especially in the 21st century, because this notion of mixed bloodism is not new. it's very old, and it's been part of the core of U.S. history, which I think a lot of these histories get left out of because we tend to focus on the things that really sort of feed sometimes our racial sentiments, and then other times it feeds the current politic of the time. And I think your blog is actually disrupting this type of relationship and really getting people to think about what's happening when we pay too much attention to one thing. Is there something that we could actually ignore by virtue of that practice?
We and Felicia were talking about that off air earlier. So yes, I think this is something that everyone needs to be more aware of, including ourselves, being more versed in it. So I guess maybe if you want to provide us some examples of the people that you're featuring in your blog piece, which will be on the Field Museum website and that we will link to when it is published.
Well, let me nerd out for a second, because then I'll let Miss Moni speak, because this was really kind of a brainchild that came from her picture, and that was Kitty Hawa dreaming. And so when I saw that, and she can talk about how much I bothered about it, one of the things that I thought it was, or it reminded me of, was the way in which, if you go into our archives, Native American advocates for sovereignty, people visiting Washington, really talked about their culture. Sometimes they talked about it in terms of a dream, or they talked about a dream in the making. And so when I saw that picture, it really got me to think about the ways in which Dusab integrated himself into her dream. And that dream would have been, you know, as an individual, she was in a matrilineal group, a society. She was the person in charge of really most of the economic backbone for her people, like other women were. And this Dusab is coming from a Creole culture, which has a lot of matrilineal influence, but at the same time, it's slightly similar and slightly different. Similar in the sense that respect for women's there, but different in the sense of most of the material culture is created by men. And so the integration of the two really showed, in a sense, the extent to which one individual suppresses their culture for the sake of becoming part of another one. And I think that is the story of Chicago, where people come into this urban environment, suppress aspects of their culture in order to be accepted and become Chicagoan. And so those two actually became the figures for this project. And one of the things I kept asking Ms. Moni was like, oh, what does this dream mean? Don't let me run off with it. But it also tied into, in a lot of cases, the early African-American scholars in anthropology, as well as in history, such as Carter G. Woodson. A lot of people talk of him in terms of the, you know, miseducation of the Negro, but they forget that some of his early and initial research was on Negro and Indian contact in Massachusetts. He went into the archives all the way back to the 1600s and revealed this incredible dynamic where it wasn't just Kitty Hawa dreaming for me. I'm now seeing linkages to dreams that had come out of the research that he had done. So this is presented, I think, first and foremost, when you look at the blog and you get a sense of this dream. And it's important. That's why I'll let Miss Moni talk about that. This dream hasn't stopped. It continues, and you see it in the creativity of the people. It also ties you into why it's important to not just think of slavery in terms of African and Native American contact. Yes, Native Americans own slaves, especially Choctaws, Cherokees, Creeks, Chickasaws, Seminoles. That's a given. But at the same time, those dynamics of slavery were shared in both master-slave relationship, but then what we also forget about in focusing on that is shared experiences as slaves. And this is one that we introduce you to in terms of some of the first who are most famous, Tituba and her husband, John Indian. We don't know much about John Indian except for that he was a Spanish Indian. But what we know about Tituba, she is not only identified as a Native woman or possibly half Negro, half Indian, she's one of the first women to be basically prosecuted during the Salem witch trials. She's also prosecuted for practicing what we would today refer to as her medicinal practices. And so this really raises the question, especially in terms of African and Native American contact, as slaves and enforced servitude, did people just forget their culture, or were aspects of it maintained? Mm-hmm. Another one that we introduced you to is a person who I hope really upsets your apple cart slightly. And this comes actually from my work on Indivisible at the Smithsonian. And that's Mr. Spence Johnson. Normally you have a lot of slave narratives that are out there, but seldom do you find a picture. It was with this individual you find both. But he gives you a sense of not just slavery in terms of experience. He actually describes for you how he was kidnapped out of the Choctaw Nation, how he was made a slave, and how his mother as well was turned into a slave, still speaking Choctaw on their plantation, still cooking for the master. And this gives us a sense of slavery and especially notions of plantation as being as multicultural as Black Indians are. These are, you know, cultural practices that are still being maintained as Native people, but yet under the status of slave. And then shared citizenship, and I promise I'll stop here. That person that I was talking about, I told you I'll nerd out on you. That person, which I think we really forget, and especially brings us back to Kitty Hawa's dream, were individuals who were free people. And so that is in particularly Paul Cuffee Jr., whose father was a slave but emancipated, became one of the greatest seafarers of African descent that we know of in the early history of the United States. His son followed in his footsteps, but he also borrowed from his mother, his Wampanoag mother, Ruth Moses, in terms of, you know, having a seafaring knowledge of the Atlantic seaboard. And so blending those two together, they're living in Westport, Massachusetts. They're one of the wealthiest families in this area. And yet, and he is a person of African and Native American ancestry as a free person. And so what this does is I really think it gives the viewer a sense of the dynamics of this history. So when we say William Loring Cates's famous title, when we say Black Indians, it hopefully inspires people to go, what kind? As opposed to just, what is that? You know, This is a matter of fact history that if we just look a little bit, and this is why I love museums, a little bit into the annals of history and material culture, it will reveal to us a history that we may have just ignored. And it's always there. It's always persistent. And this is where I'll pass it over to Miss Moni. It's still evolving.
Absolutely. So, yeah, mixing is definitely something my family on both sides had no problem with. we have stories. My great-grandma on my mom's side was about my skin tone. So everybody's like, okay, there was some Choctaw or something. So, like, that's, you know, the story that goes. And sometimes those kind of stories get lost or just brushed aside where, you know, it wasn't always great to identify as an African American, you know, in a lot of generations, unfortunately, and being able to claim something other than that was a way to go. So unfortunately, you know, we do see certain elements of racism that can show up on both sides. And when I say both sides, I mean like even from Native folks who immediately will question, okay, so here's this Black Native person, and they kind of put them up to a different sort of scrutiny than they would for a white Native person. And I just want to make sure that people understand that we are very, like, that there's so many of us that are out there, and our stories deserve to be told. And that's why I always try to emphasize, like, yes, I am triracial. And yes, I know a lot of other folks that do identify in certain ways, and I want to make sure that their stories are out there. And Kitty Hawa and Dusabo, once I heard about their story, I actually ended up just having a crush right away. I was like, this sounds amazing. Tell me more about this Potawatomi woman who fell for this Black Haitian. but I was approached by the Floating Museum, who was actually doing some work at research at the Field Museum. And this was while I was a volunteer. And the more we got to talking with the folks there and the different artists, you know, they presented this project of the founders. So they would have these massive outdoor exhibitions showcasing art and different things. And they wanted to represent different folks from Chicago that don't always get the recognition. So like Dusabo, Kitty Hawa, Harold Washington, and just the work that folks do at the Dusabo Museum here in Chicago. And so I actually ended up sitting as the model for Kitty Hawa because I really thought that, well, I may not be full blood native, but this would be a accurate representation of what their children probably look like. And it's just something, kind of shout out to them, because we don't have a lot of that history written down. And so if there's any way to kind of at least acknowledge and honor those folks that were part of this bigger vision of what Chicago could be, where it could be something that was integrated and opened up trade, you know, for different folks to come into the area. And I just thought it was just such a beautiful message. So of course aside from doing the modeling, I also did some artwork called Kitty Hawa Dreaming. So yeah, this has been great.
Can you talk to us more about Kitty and Dusable? I know that you've discussed it a little bit, but what was her dream? I know we've been alluding to it a little bit, but just to get some clarity.
I believe her vision was to have something that was fully integrated, where it was something that she didn't necessarily envision, like, okay, well, white people would just be taking over and just completely doing their own thing and excluding, you know, the black and brown folks that worked so tirelessly to help make this, you know, a beautiful environment. You know, Chicago is just such a lovely space, and it's something that I think that they wanted to really open up to the rest of the world. But I think Rob could also talk a little bit more.
I think that's a great introduction to it, because her dream is, you know, definitely about engaging in that which she was familiar with, you know, trade, so much to the point that, you know, she's multilingual. We know this from the few records that survived the Chicago fire. You know, people write about it. Even some of the dignitaries that are later in Chicago history, such as Mays and others, they emulate in some cases the home of Kitty Hawa and Dusable. They engage in the same, you know, trade practices. And it's, I keep saying that, but I haven't given you examples. You know, it's important to know that we're not talking about just this woman sitting on the edge of a river. I guess that would be down towards Printer Row looking at it. She had a bakery, she had a dairy, she had a farm, she had a smokehouse, she had a poultry house, she had a mill. So basically she's the infrastructure of early Chicago, in my opinion. Dusable is an incredible pioneer and trader. So he's not only interacting with the Potawatomi, he's engaging with other Native nations that are in the area and beyond in order to ensure that that trade is occurring. So if we look at the river, actually, at the mouth, where Chicago sits, we can actually imagine many canoes, many small boats bringing in trade goods from all over. And then you have the Mississippi, which is connecting all of Louisiana at the time. So New Orleans, that actually Dusable goes through, is bringing up that Gulf culture to the north, and vice versa. People are going down. So in the sense, her dream is really about, I think, self-determination, and self-determination with new people that she's coming into contact with and creating new aims and values together. And I think you see it ultimately not only in what they're able to, the mark they're able to leave on Chicago in terms of its culture and how people interact, but also its sense of self. One of the things coming from California, I've always noticed, especially coming to Chicago, is Chicagoans are really proud. There is, you know, a Chicago dog is something they will make you eat. And there is a certain amount of baseball that you had knowledge that you must have. And so I think that's not, you know, while it's a new phenomenon, I don't think that it's divorced from the history in its origin.
Definitely. I know that we would love to be able to show your artwork, Monica, on our website and on the Instagram that goes along with this story, so people can get a feel for what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I could just sit and listen to these stories all day. Miranda and I were talking just before you guys came onto our Zoom about how we want to have story time on the podcast. I'm personally like really fascinated with the story and history of Tituba. Like Miranda and I both spent time in Salem, Massachusetts, and it is just so interesting to see how much the Salem witch trials inform the, you know, economy and current culture of that place. And so I loved hearing you speak about that and then reading a little bit as I got a sneak peek at your blog post.
Great. And, you know, and hopefully that inspired you to think about, especially a person who I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, and that's George Bunga. So while I talk about DuSable as this great pioneer and trader, you know, engaging in fur trade, fishing, et cetera, George Bunga, who is actually, he's descended of the first individual of African descent, Pierre Bunga, or he was actually African, Pierre Bunga, and his mom, who was Ojibwa, he's literally descended of the first African individual in what we would refer to now as Minnesota and Wisconsin. And so this individual also is trading in the same territory as Kitihawa and DuSable. You can read his letters about what that trade is like. He's like them, multilingual. And he's also very much in line with what we would refer to today as sovereignty and self-determination. He is very much an advocate for his mother's people. His wife is Ojibwa as well. And if you go to places like Red Lake and other Ojibwa communities, you hear Bunga as last name all over the place. And it's kind of interesting because for a lot of the individuals I've consulted on this history, it's a matter of fact history that that was their ancestor. But for many Americans, in terms of not only his fur trade activity and helping to establish what at that point was the Northwest Fur Trade Company, and also the diplomacy necessary for keeping 20,000 Ojibwa warriors at bay because these new people are coming into their territory and establishing, you know, fair trade, he's a person that we should remember, because without him, there would be no U.S. history in this territory. And without the Ojibwa even acknowledging his diplomatic activities and engaging what he wanted to do on level of equality, the United States would be a very different place. And so these histories actually, I think, should remind us not only of their agency and ingenuity, but also to some extent, what we can do going forward. That ingenuity still continues.
So, and I think for me, it was a good, what can we do then? What can we do as individuals, but also like, how does your identity influence the work that you, I know you both hinted at it, but how does that manifest into the work that you're doing day in and day out?
Well, anybody who knows me knows that I am always a huge proponent of representation, and accurate representation. I love hearing people's stories, and I love being able to help amplify and express those stories. So whether that's through my writing, when I write, I use my family last name, White Pigeon, and that is just, you know, kind of my nod to them, but, you know, it's also just trying to keep that lineage alive and knowing that there are Native people that are out there that can share these stories. And that's always one thing that I've, so often other people will talk about Native culture and Native identity and different things, but they're not. And it's just letting people know that, no, we can speak for ourselves, just like African-Americans can speak for themselves and everybody, you know. So I try to make sure that I do that, especially with my writing, and then with projects that I select for my visual work. I've actually just finished a children's book called Journey of the Freckled Indian, and that was in collaboration with former Miss Alaska, Alyssa London, and Preston Singletary, and they're both Tlingit. So it focuses on this Alaska Native girl who is mixed, and she gets bullied at school for not looking Indian enough, and her kind of learning about her culture and just trying to reconnect and, you know, really going through this whole self-discovery journey of, you know, you don't have to give that power to other people to really, you know, say, this is who you are, because you should know who you are and you know how you can identify and what you can embrace, and you know, you can showcase as much or as little culture as you want. Honestly, it's up to you. But, you know, you should definitely be proud of, you know, what goes into your identity. So And then there was just, that collaboration was just such a great, great opportunity and getting to learn about this whole other side of Native culture, like on the whole other coast, and to also work with, you know, this world famous glass sculptor who has a whole different style than me, because I have a little bit more of an animation, like cartoony background. So dealing with a fine artist and trying to translate that was,
for me, it's about teaching the history. I think for African America, this is a history that is in need of investigation and further discussion, particularly because it's a leftover from slavery. Kinship was not really talked much about. People kept to their families, but the understanding of the dynamics of who was part of that family is something that we still need to revisit, especially because kin could be sold away. And so by getting into this history in terms of the kinship, who, what slave relationships were like, we can begin to see that, you know, there was, and historians don't always like to talk about this, but even in this ugly situation called slavery, there was love, there was trust, there was affection. And so that's what I like to give my students, and especially that's why I nerded out on this blog. The other part, I think, for Native America is also very similar. Blood quantum really disrupts people's sense of being and belonging. And while that is important to grasp in terms of self-determination and sovereignty, it is not the only way in which kinship was constructed. And so that's what I want to really, especially in not only on this blog, but in, when I teach, I want to give, you know, especially young Native students, young African-American students, a sense of the breadth in which kinship was discussed, used, and practiced, and the ways in which people, even those who were not blood related, could be brought into the fold. Sometimes that those blood relations even were not recognized by other people, but still recognized by the family. And if you read slave narratives, you see, you read that all the time. And especially with the one I presented to you, with Mr. Spence Johnson. And then most importantly, that this third element of contact is a history that we have to investigate. And following the footsteps of, say, William Cates, as well as, you know, why am I blanking on his name? Jack Forbes. You know, we have an opportunity to bring back to life that which folks ignored because of race, ignored because they were trying to cope with imposed colonization, and they struggled just to make the basic sense out of blood quantum and do it the best way that they can. And then for African Americans, being included and excluded based upon skin color and appearance, hair texture, eye color, et cetera. Mm-hmm. This was all part of that process that actually not only allowed for the survival of this individual called a Black Indian, but it also should remind us that this is what people had to do as African Americans and Native Americans in order to survive. And so that's just having a basic understanding of those stories, I think, really gives us, hopefully today, and I know they do for me every time I read one of them, is it inspires me to continue going. So I will never know how hard it was. I listen to groups like Bamuwa, which is one reason why I threw that in there. They're constantly reminding people of not only the importance of Nupiaq language, but also the importance of contemporary practice. There are people like Miss Moni, but you've heard from her, so I won't go off about that. That remind us that this everyday creativity that we see in individuals today is reflective of a creativity that has always been. And so once we grasp all of that, it's, I think, possible to reconcile ourselves with both the pains of history, but then also the exciting ingenuity that people engaged in as they were going through these really difficult times. And I don't know, that gives me hope.
Absolutely.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Oh, me and Felicia, again, though, we're talking about this blood quantum issue earlier before we got on Zoom, and this goes right into the subject, right, of questioning each other, which is, I think, the worst part of it is that it's, you know, we are attacking each other. Yeah. And I don't know anyone else's story but my own, you know. Mm-hmm. And so who am I to say what is or who they are? And it feeds into these narratives of that have long plagued our communities, of anti-Black narratives, and, you know, even Mexican anti-Mexican, other indigenous mm-hmm. groups. It's in our own communities.
Yeah. Blood quantum is that's a hard issue. I mean, even in the book, in that Journey of Freckled Indian, you know, in the foreword, we go right into that right away because, you know, we also want that to be a learning tool or something that parents or teachers can, you know, approach that subject, because that does end up messing with people's psyche and just trying to figure out, like, okay, why are we the only race that has to identify or have to be right. card-carrying individuals? And, you know, that was a tactic to disenfranchise and just, you know, allow us to disappear altogether. So do we feed into that or do we try to step away? So moving forward, you know, you definitely have to look at the past, recognize your present, and then, you know, plan for a better future and something that's definitely more inclusive, something that's more diverse, and, you know, something that should be allowed to evolve.
I agree. And I can say, especially in terms of blood quantum and looking at the past, that's why I love staying academic and nerding out on things. It's, you can learn strategies from these stories and what people did and give you a sense of what life was like before blood quantum was even created. And I think that actually in all of these stories, you get that message. Especially from the historical ones, is that this was done before blood quantum, before regulation. And so if they were able to create family, common culture, shared kinship, creative resistance together, then it's still possible today. And all we have to do is just engage in it.
That's great. Thank you. I feel like you guys have both been touching on this throughout the conversation, but, you know, Miranda mentioned that we were both just speaking about how ill-informed we are about Afro-Indigenous identity and Afro-Indigenous experiences. I would love to hear about what you'd want people to know about Blackness in Indigenous communities.
We got a right to be here.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there's just so many shared stories and just shared histories, or there's a lot of commonalities where you're like, oh, you went through that too? Like, oh, that's interesting. So I'm hoping that people recognize the similarities and just, you know, this was kind of, we kind of got screwed on so many right. levels, but, you know, we don't have to live in that trauma or stay in that. And I think we're also getting to that point where there's so many more people that have been able to, are on platforms now that can actually share these stories, get them out to the masses. And, you know, more people are actually identifying that, oh yeah, actually, yeah, those stories were also in my family, or, you know, we had similar experiences.
I think what I would like folks to know is that there's no one existence. If you are African American with Native ancestry, that was part of, you know, love, and that created a common bond. It was trust. And I think that gives us a sense that actually love is able to transcend race. And if you are a person of Native descent in an African American community, one of the things is that there is a suppression of that Native culture for the sake of belonging. And that was normal. For individuals who are of African descent in Native communities, the same thing happened. And it is a normal process. That shared kinship represents a bond of trust that we don't tend to think about when we think of different cultures in contact with each other, especially if we use a narrative of colonization. We assume that colonization is the programmable blueprint which everybody followed, and it kept races separate. And in reality, what we see from the historical record is that folks are just like those folks today that say race has no bearing on how I interact with people. But to go more seriously to your question, what I really want folks to know is that this third line of contact was one that actually helped to create what we refer to as U.S. history. for Native Americans and African Americans interacting with each other in, say, African American communities, which is why it's important to understand the relevance of Native America to Black history. This created not only families with shared kinship, it also created alliances by which people struggled through slavery together. They fought, for example, oppression by slave owners. They also, in many cases, shared their languages, their food practices, and especially if you go to places like New Orleans, and I'm even learning with Indianapolis and Indiana, you can see a lot of Native presence in the food practices of African Americans, such as cornbread. In New Orleans, for example, the gumbo. Gumbo has both red, white, and black. If you are an individual of African descent within Native communities, know that that is reflective of not only an exercise of sovereignty by the nation sometimes in terms of self-determination and including people as we get with the Seminoles, but also in many cases, it was not about the nation. It was individuals who were citizens of sovereign nations exercising their free agency will, as well as their sovereignty, to create families, to, in some cases, especially if we look at people like George Bunga, to ensure that the person who was different in Native society became part of the normal ways for the Native people, of the Native people. So when you look at, for example, the picture of George Bunga that we've included in the blog, you see that he has a top hat and coat. He's definitely of his time. But take a look at his shoes. Those are his moccasins, and those moccasins are made by his wife, which she forced him to wear every single day to show where in Ojibwa society he was. And so, and don't take my word for it, go into his letters where he actually talks about his wife. And this gives you a sense of people engaging not in terms of the nation and the individual. These are families that do the same thing that we do today. And so that's what I want folks to leave with. While it may create a history that causes us to be uncomfortable, we start to see the human factor where these folks are doing things that if we had lived at that time, we possibly would be doing as well.
So how can we teach about this in museums? And like, how do we teach this publicly? That's what I'm left with.
I'm going to first say nerd out on the suggested readings that I gave you. But no, but the beauty, I think the beauty, especially for those interested in the field of museum studies, become that storyteller. I think museum practitioners are some of the greatest storytellers in our country. And they're able to bring, especially what we're seeing in this paradigm shift with the field museum, they're wedding material culture, objects of cultural patrimony, with narratives and what people actually did with those objects. And that really gives you a sense of not them being objects. These are tools of everyday life. And so for the person who's aspiring to become a field, you know, field staff, a docent, administrator, this is a great way to take the stories from history. Yes, nerding out on the list I gave you, but take the stories from history and then wedding and seeing what you can come up with in that those repositories that we refer to as collections. That would then not only keep the stories fresh, but it also gives that new practitioner a chance to make those stories a part of his, her, or their time today. And that then keeps history alive and the memory of these people going. Otherwise, they can easily be forgotten. And I presented these individuals to you all in this blog, particularly because of that reason. If we don't study them, and this was not made by, the statement was not made by me. This was actually made by Montague Cobb, who was the first physical anthropologist, African-American physical anthropologist, as well as Carter G. Woodson. If no one studies these individuals, they will fall out of history, not because people push them out, but because folks just forgot them.
That, yeah, that is a great segue into my response. Because I think a lot of times we just, ultimately, we don't want to be forgotten. I mean, think about like how far back in your own family lines can you list off certain names and folks. So if we can help breathe some life into, you know, these stories and focus on certain individuals and make sure that that was presented, like, no, these aren't just issues that are happening just today. These are things that have happened in the past, and this is how people used to deal with this. And showing like a side-by-side of past and then contemporary, or how certain people are still keeping certain practices together. I mean, like Miranda, you and I have talked about the basket weaving, you know, in California, and how it was just so amazing that these women were able to, you know, just keep these practices alive and still doing, you know, what they needed to survive. So I think just being able to recognize that there are certain stories or certain objects and things that were collected at museums that were actually, you know, collected properly or bought, you know, from folks instead of just being stolen, and actually emphasizing certain of those objects throughout museums. I think that will also help too.
Agreed. I don't know if Felicia wants to ask something.
My gosh, you guys are just so thorough. You answered three questions that you had written down in one. Let's see. I think it's really amazing that you guys have both been talking about this, the importance of continuity and highlighting that and drawing comparisons between the past and the present. I'm curious about, you guys have been talking really highly about this work that you've done with the Field Museum. Are there any other institutions that you feel are doing a great job at representing these stories that you'd like to highlight?
I would say yes. I have to give, you know, kudos to my co-curators on Indivisible. African Native American Lives in the Americas was the title of the exhibit. It was one of the longest running as a collaboration between the different museums. That had never happened before, from what I was told. And so bringing what is now built, actually, it was before the African American Museum of History and Culture was built. Only thing was laid was the cornerstone. And bringing the National Museum of the American Indian together with the Smithsonian, who is responsible for American heritage, so to speak, having all of those individual groups in conversation with each other, actually, I think spurs my passion for the information I'm presenting to you all. And I think that's important to think about, because usually museums will focus on only one thing. But when you brought all three together, you got this picture of African and Native American lives in the Americas that I think for most of the folks that I heard when they went through exhibits and I had to visit as it was traveling across the country, they had known about the history, and it was great to see themselves finally. It was a component of their history, especially for a lot of Native folk who knew that, you know, their grandmother was half Black, or that their grandfather was half Black, or, you know, one of their uncles had married an individual who was Seminole. All of these family stories started to come out. And I think that that's something, especially for Native people, is important to remember, aside from blood quantum and sovereignty discussions, the family stories. These family stories are priceless, and that they are the driving force in many cases of notions of being and belonging. So I give, you know, definite respect to the Smithsonian Institution, I'll say as a whole, because they all see themselves as one, even though they're different museums. And I would say the Field, having the courage to bring this conversation forward, like the, it was the Tin Bears Museum in Oklahoma and the Southwest Museum who brought Indivisible to it. You all are engaging in a dialogue that can create a lot of tension, make people very uncomfortable, but doing it in a way that gets folks to see themselves not as just a part of history, but that their families have created these histories that we know today, especially if we're talking in terms of Native American history and African American history. So this is those are two that I would point out, actually four, that I would really point out, because they had the courage to engage in the conversation, to rethink, you know, objects of cultural patrimony and curation, to rethink the role of people's voices in museum space, and then create something out of it that everyone can benefit from and learn from.
I feel like I don't have as much experience in this field. But, you know, what I have seen over the Field Museum for the past several years has just been incredible. And a lot of times it's just when you actually see an institution making the effort, we know it's going to be difficult. We know it's going to take a long time to get certain things or to get fully to where we should be. But if we see more people engaging with each other, having these conversations, you know, the fact that you folks are even doing this podcast, I think is amazing. And it's something that I hope other states and other folks at other various institutions can start, you know, not mimicking, but, you know, keep expanding and just keep going with this, because we need to have, you know, these different discussions and how we move forward. How is the human race going to, you know, just remember certain things or certain elements of cultures in the future and what we think should be preserved, and trying to make sure that people are accurately represented. So, you know, I love that the Field Museum is working with contemporary Native artists to get, you know, their work out there and to add to their collections and whatnot. So I'm hoping that more folks will, you know, take a cue.
Your art does that. Your art does that. Yes. That's your cool. Yeah, me too. No. Any advice for the young ones coming up and who identify as Black and Native, and on what and how to just, you know, be proud of who they are and or to do this type of work?
It's small victories, really. I mean, you have your vision for what the future can be, but you got to be able to recognize and appreciate the small victories here and there. And, you know, just getting your supporters and different folks that agree with or align with your certain type of thinking. So it's going to be rough, but don't give up. You know, just keep going, and your voice deserves to be heard.
And I'll piggyback off of that and say, just, you know, jump in it and then just be. That was the advice that was given to me by Miss Ruth Hopper, who was one of my undergrad advisors. It's always stuck with me. Once you are, you know, if you're passionate about this work, just do it and pay, you know, just be in it. You know, bring your voice to it, bring your all to it, and it will pay off. For those who are going, oh, I won't make any money, and I know that for my students, that's always an issue. You will. The money will come. What is more important, I think, is the contribution of not just your voice, of what Ms. Moni pointed out, but also your perspective. You know, what you know from the histories that your parents have given you, that your community has given you, what society has given you, and how you make sense of this work is what's crucial and vital. I think that's what feeds museums. That's definitely what feeds academia. And you will find out that it'll feed you too.
Yes, that's great advice from both of you. Thank you. Well, I think we're winding down here. We're getting to that point in our podcast where we highlight different Indigenous artists. So Miranda and I usually will highlight our earring makers, but if you guys have another artist that you want to highlight, we definitely welcome that.
Besides Monica.
There's a lot of people in there doing some amazing, amazing mm-hmm. stuff. You know, actually, I love Andrea Carlson's mm-hmm. work. I think it's just ridiculous what she ends up doing, and like the scale yeah. as well. Mm-hmm. The amount of detail, and just, you know, she, you know, and she'll actively, you know, address certain institutions and museums and call them out, and they'll be like, okay, let's work with yeah. you.
So I love it. Definitely. Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to go the music route. I'm going to say Bamiyowa. Bamiyowa is really an incredible group of people. If you ever get a chance to see them live, and actually I have not only a love for them because they gave us our theme song for the Indivisible exhibit, because they had heard us, they had seen an announcement, and I guess they had overheard some conversations by some of the Smithsonian folk talking about what we were planning on doing. And the statement from all of them was like, you're going to talk about Black Indians. You're going to tell United States people about Black Indians. People are going to bite and spit and kick. And that's just like herding reindeer. So their reindeer herding song was actually the theme for the Indivisible exhibit. And I would say that, you know, that draws me to not just their work, but also something that they're known for with their music. They're not only teaching Anupiaq language and fusing it with gospel out of, you know, African-American gospel rhythms, but they're also telling stories, family stories, everyday life stories that really, as I've seen from some of the students that I've had who are Inupiaq descent, really gives them a sense that it's okay to be, and that that is normal, and that, you know, what they love about their Inupiaq culture is, you know, as important as maintaining as their African-American ancestry. And so I would really point that out to not just African-Americans and Native American mixed blood and young folk, but to all young folk. You know, that the fusion you represent is something to honor and respect. It's what brought your folks together. It's also what is going to keep you all going in the future. And so, you know, kudos to Bamiwa for doing that. And so now if you see, you know, on YouTube, you got all these Inupiaq rappers, you got these Inupiaq musicians that, you know, they're using their language there, and it's now becoming normal, you know, to use a language that at one time was outlawed. And that's something I think we can all honor.
Yes, definitely. Thank you. Felicia, do you want to say who you're wearing today?
Sure. Man, that is tough.
I know. Tough act to follow. Like, I don't know if I can now.
Well, my earrings are made by, for those of you on the video, you can see them. There's some really beautiful dentalium and beaded earrings made by Michaela Patton, who is an Oglala Lakota artist that I just really admire. And she makes a lot of really beautiful jewelry, but she also makes her own paper and makes these incredible sculptures from her handmade paper. So definitely check her out, and we'll be sharing folks' social media handles or websites on our Instagram.
Yeah, I took off mine because they're too small. These are abalone shell and beads by her name is Desiree Martinez. She is Tongva and is an archaeologist who works on helping to bring awareness to the Tongva as an unfederally recognized tribe in California. And she's been to the Field Museum. She does a lot of outreach with the Autry in terms of repatriation. And so I think it goes back to saying how, you know, we're not just one thing. We're not just an archaeologist. We're not just this. We're artists. We're creators. So this was so great. Thank you both so, so much. I always learn from you both. So thank you.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thank you.